And so this becomes a challenge for us to reflect on where in our communities, particularly in our indigenous communities, are these realities occurring. So we know that in Canada, there are some communities, indigenous communities, that have had boiled water alerts for 20 years. This is unbelievable, right? So imagine if we in Toronto went home tonight and we couldn't drink our water, it was contaminated. We had a boiled water alert. Okay, how long is it going to last? A day? That's a long time. 2 days? Well, for many of our indigenous brothers and sisters, this is years and an intolerable period of time. So this is part of the structure of contaminated water that flows along the fault lines of social, political, economic, gendered, cultural dislocation and dichotomy and oppression. So this is where the churches have been very keen in bringing the history of social analysis to questions of the environment. So water and justice is an issue. And we know that this is an issue here, and also, of course, an issue around the world and in the global south. Again, I just want to highlight three of what might be considered the most contaminated or polluted places in the world. One is Kabwe, Zambia, where lead and cadmium soak the hills after decades of mine processing. Children here have concentrations 5 to 10 times permissible U.S. EPA levels. The ground is so contaminated that nothing can grow. This is the border between the Dominican Republic and Haiti. Haiti was once 60% covered in forest. Only 2% of the country still has trees at this point. This aerial picture shows how Haiti has been absolutely deforested up to the border in this area. Many people say that any refugee from Haiti is now an environmental refugee. And this is the Yumuna River. And here you see two children swimming. Can you see them, Kristen, the two children? They're not dead. They're just swimming. But this is one of the largest tributaries of the Ganges. But 58% of the city's waste gets dumped straight into this river. And millions of Indians still rely on this for cooking, cleaning, even drinking. And this is part of this history of who gets to feel the brunt of environmental destruction and of contaminated water. Leonardo Boff, a liberation theologian in Brazil, has been one to articulate the connection between the concern for the poor and concern for the earth. He was twice silenced by the Vatican under the papacies of John Paul II and of Pope Benedict. However, in the latest encyclical by Pope Francis, not only was Leonardo Boff not silenced, he was brought to the Vatican to consult on the actual document. And he was actually quoted in terms of his book title, Option for the Poor, Option for the Earth, in the papal encyclical. Not attributed, but the title is there, and the Pope is affirming that dual option. So Leonardo Boff from Brazil, in a sense, is experiencing a kind of recrudescence in the Catholic world by making this connection between the poor of the earth and the oppressed species and ecosystems of the planet. So this connection between water and justice is an important one. Also, water and relationality, water and relationships. And these are pictures of indigenous men and women who have been, in many ways, helping us see these deep connections of interrelationship as they pertain to ourselves and the more than human world. Orrin Lyons, who teaches at State University of New York, Buffalo, and is an elder in his community teaching traditional indigenous cosmologies and lifeways. Audrey Shenandoah of the Onondaga in upstate New York. Danny Beaton, who's a filmmaker, Mohawk here in Toronto. And Wilmer Najuan, 95-year-old former chief of Cape Croker, World War II combat veteran, founder of the Ontario Native Council, and an amazing human being, still active. A number of years ago, when some of you might remember the, I'm just going to adjust the lighting a little bit here for AV lighting. Forgive me if I get it wrong, but I think I I'll just try it here. We're going to get the AV set here. So Wilmer, at 90 years old, or 88 years old, was invited by Danny Beaton to come down from... Let me just get another one here. Is that going? Okay, here we go. Was invited to come down to Elmvale, where dump site 41 was endangering one of the cleanest aquifers in the world. You guys remember this? This was not all that long ago. The city of Elmville in that area had decided they wanted to put a dump site 41, right above one of the cleanest aquifers in the world that flows into Georgian Bay. The indigenous women of Christian Island said, this isn't going to happen. We do not want this to happen. They had a camping out site right across from the fenced gates where the digging had started, and they were joined by others eventually. Danny Beaton was one of those who invited Wilmer down, and Wilmer, at 88 or so, comes down and camps out by the fire to help stop this. This is a success story. It was stopped. Elizabeth May joined in that struggle, Maud Barlow. Farmers from the region committed civil disobedience. 80-year-old farmers, so-called settler farmers, were there also protesting. And when Wilmer talked about it, he said, growing up on Georgian Bay, we were taught, you know, taking care of the water, it makes a lot of sense because we're dependent on the water, right? I mean, if you pollute the waters, you die. But this is something that we have to protect. And I sometimes think of how we are destroying our waters in a way of destroying ourselves. I mean, we're almost 70% water in our bodies, right? What happens when we pollute the waters of Lake Ontario and then try to clean it up and bring it into our taps and drink it? What does that do to us? It'd be like inviting you all over to a picnic and I'm going to serve you lemonade out of a gas can, right? It's okay, I've cleaned it, right? It's all washed. It's like, that's nuts. That's a cultural pathology. But in a sense, that's what we're doing to our waterways, contaminating them, and then trying to clean them up to serve them. You can't have healthy people on a sick planet. We can't be well with our waters contaminated. And this is some of the basic wisdom that people like Wilmer Najuan, Audrey Shenandoah, and many of our indigenous brothers and sisters here are reminding us. And many of you are part of the walks that are occurring around the Great Lakes. And many of you know of Josephine, Nokomis Josephine Mandeman, who has done walks around the Great Lakes. She has walked the shorelines of 5 Great Lakes, literally walked more than 20,000 kilometers for the water. And it's equal to nearly half the Earth's circumference. As an indigenous woman trying to raise awareness around how sacred and important the waters are. She writes, you as an individual, no matter whether you are indigenous or non-indigenous, you can take steps in your day-to-day life in ensuring there is clean water for future generations. She does it by walking, and many people join her in walking and celebrating water. But this notion of water and relationship, it's part of us. What does that do when we commodify water? Are we commodifying 70% of our bodies and saying that most of us is for sale? Something to think about in terms of water and relationship. Another notion here of water, in addition to relationality, is water and worldviews. And indigenous worldviews, as well as worldviews from other traditions, have become very important in our dialogue around environmental sustainability and how we treat ecosystems, such as aquatic ecosystems. One person who is helping us think about this on a very pragmatic level in terms of wellness is Richard Louv. And Richard Louv is the author of Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. And he is a great advocate now for helping children be well by spending time in swamps, in ponds, in mud holes, in waterways, in ravines, climbing trees, etc. Because in this book, he looks at the rise among our children of attention deficit disorder, of depression, of psychological disorders, etc. And he has study after study that he quotes from the UK, Canada, the United States, showing that when children are put in contact with non-human nature, they often improve radically. So in California, they have a new policy in some of the school districts. No child left inside. They all have to go outside. And Richard Louv has one time been asked to speak to, it was a number of years ago, it was the American Pediatrics Association, or Pediatricians Association, 5,000 pediatricians. And his wife is a nurse, and he was very nervous. He was very nervous doing this, right? So his wife said, it's okay. And he said, no, I don't know. I'm a little nervous to speak to these doctors. So she grabs him by the lapel and said, listen, Richard, they're not like other doctors. They're nice people. I said, oh, okay. So he relaxed. He gives his talk. Well, a number of doctors come up to him, and many have subsequently written to him and said, you've changed the way I'm practicing medicine. Right now, there is an inner city park in Portland, Oregon, where students and children go with their quote-unquote prescriptions from their doctors. And they see the park staff, and the park staff say, okay. And they design a program around what they see. So, climb two maples and call me in the morning. But actually, it's more involved than that. But they spend time in the waterways, on the trees, etc. And wellness is part of that relationship. That this is important, not only for children, but for all of us, to be in contact with other than human nature, with the more than human world. This is what grounds us. And the waters in our body respond to the waters in the earth's body. And this is a connection that isn't just metaphysical or metaphorical. It's biochemical. And this is, again, part of the crescendo of reflection on the importance of water and non-colonized water, non-oppressed and buried water, water that is allowed to flow and to flow freely and into our lives and that we're allowed to traipse in and be part of. Also, in terms of a kind of worldview perspective, this understanding that our conversation about water involves a larger worldview of our relationship to the non-human world. And here the work of Thomas Berry is very important. Some of you may have remembered Tom Berry when he used to come to Canada every year at Port Burwell, Ontario. Any of you ever go to that seminar at Port Burwell or hear Tom Berry speak back there? Yeah. Tom Berry was a cultural historian, Roman Catholic priest. He had taught world religions at Fordham University and then retired for his really important work, which was looking at the role of the human in the unfolding of the universe and how that impinges on our ecological integrity. One of his works is called The Great Work, and this was how do we, as a culture now, face the great work of healing human-earth relations, having a relationship that is mutually enhancing rather than rapaciously destroying non-human nature. That's the great work we're called to. And he begins to articulate this in ways that were very compelling to many activists and politicians, including Al Gore. He became what I would call the Yoda to Al Gore's Luke Skywalker. And Tom would also speak kind of like Yoda. I mean, he was kind of old and talking like this back then. Anyway, amazing man. And his work is now very influential for people like Richard Louv, David Suzuki, and others. And his archives are now at Harvard. It's interesting. When he was at Fordham, he never became a full professor, But his work is remembered and transformative far beyond many who've worked in that field. But he talks about this need to listen to non-human nature, other than human nature. That we have to learn to listen because we've become deaf to the voices of the natural world. And he said, we have to learn to listen again. because the psychic spiritual energy that we need to find a new relationship lies in that listening. He tells a story once of going up to Cape Croker on the Bruce Peninsula. He was invited to speak to a group of indigenous elders, including Orrin Lyons, Tom Porter, Danny Beaton was there. And he was kind of nervous to speak, and he was standing on the shores of Georgian Bay at Cape Croker. And he said, "What can I tell these elders?" And he listened to the water lap with low sounds on the shore, and he listened to the wind blow through the trees, and he said, "Okay, I will tell them the story of the universe unfolding as I know it. And I'll try to listen and tell them how I try to listen." After that, Tom Porter came to him and said, "You must have indigenous blood in you for you to tell that story. Thank you. And we can understand this." And so part of the humility of listening, I think, is something that is important for our perspective, our worldview, our wellness, and our dialogue with those who are embracing these causes around water and around ecological integrity. And for me, Tom Berry and that kind of humble listening is an important concern. And now I just want to talk about water and the sacred. As you know, in the Christian tradition, water has a sacral dimension, a sacred dimension. It's part of the Eucharistic rite. It is part of our understanding of how we are initiated into the faith through baptism. It is part of what spilled out of the dying Christ, the dying Jesus, when his side was pierced and blood and water came out. It has special sacral significance in the Christian tradition. What happens when it's commodified and turned into not a sense of the sacred presence of the risen Christ, but a commodity to be bought, sold, used, and discarded? What happens when this sacred part of our tradition simply becomes part of the marketplace? I think it asks a question: what is not for sale? What in our tradition is not for sale? And the crescendo of concern around water today is accenting this. Development and Peace from the Catholic perspective, Kairos from the interfaith, inter-Christian perspective, Shoresh Jewish Environmental Network from the Jewish perspective, and many other groups have been arguing very strenuously, water for life, not for profit. That water is a basic human right. That water is something we all need to live. And it can't just be marketed and sold as if it's some product or luxury item. Without water, we die. If they could harvest and sell air and would deny it to people who didn't have enough money, what would that be? What's the same with water? And this is why just recently a number of religious leaders in southern Ontario, including Bishop Crosby of Hamilton, and other faith leaders, have come out with a statement critiquing the taking of water in Aberfoyle by Nestle. And isn't that amazing that they've come out and said this should stop? And that Bishop Crosby, and this is going on in other communities, said we have to take the lead here. So I'm encouraging all our parishes to stop using bottled water. This is something sacred to us. We cannot just act as if it's another piece of furniture to be bought, sold, used, and discarded. This is essential to our sacral and social justice understanding. These are leaders who are embracing this. A little story about this. About 12 years ago, a film called Thirst on the commodification of water was produced, and it opened at the Hot Dogs Festival at U of T. And it looked at the actual commodification and commercialization of water and the corporatization of water in several communities. Cochabamba in Bolivia, where the water was privatized and people had to go to the streets. One boy shot and killed trying to protest that. Even the rainwater was owned by the Bechtel Corporation. You could not harvest rainwater according to that deal because the corporation owned it. The price jumped between 30 and 300% when it was privatized. People could not afford water. So they took to the streets. It was a violent series of protests, but eventually Bechtel had to go away. The government intervened and broke the contract. It looks at a community in India where there's an alternative approach to harvesting water, and Stockton, California, where they sold the public water utility to a private corporation. Anyway, sitting in the theater were a number of students. And again, this is about a dozen years ago. And the director was there answering questions. And one student had a bottle of water in his hand and said, looking at this film, it makes me realize I probably shouldn't buy bottled water. So, I'm sorry. I knocked that one out of here. Okay. I really did it this time. Okay. So anyway, I'm not able to buy, I shouldn't buy this bottled water. And the director said, yeah, it's come back. God love miracles, eh? And the director said, yeah. Fast forward 10 years, and the UTM campus, and we have some representatives from the University of Toronto Mississauga campus here, said, we're no longer going to have bottled water available at the University of Toronto Mississauga campus. And then it was followed the next year by the St. George campus. No longer are we going to have bottled water on our campus. 10 years. But the seed was planted, and you saw a student looking askance at a bottle of water saying, maybe this isn't a good idea. And now we're having Bishop Crosby and other faith leaders from the Anglican Church, from the United Church, also say, this is not a good idea. And it's not in keeping with our value system. Because we're seeing the confluence of cosmology, worldview, sacral understanding of water, and social justice issues. Water as a basic human right. The poor and the marginalized having dirty water, and the more affluent having access to clean water. This is a social justice issue. So the social justice teachings of the faith communities, combining with the cosmological, spiritual, sacral dimensions, are now flowing together in a very powerful confluence. And when you have the spirit and the legs, the head and the heart, the mysterium and the marching all together, you have a powerful unity. And that's what we're called to be part of now. This is actually an amazing time. And this is a gift, just as water is a gift. And I think we're invited now to embrace that gift and to think about how we and our children's children and future generations are going to look at us with blessing or with curse. Did we embrace this time? Did we unite with those who are seeing these deep interconnections and saying, water for life, not for sale. That water is the life flow and the lifeblood of who we are. That water is indeed that which gives us life. And unless we embrace this, we are not choosing life. We know from the Hebrew scriptures, it's put to us, I put before you death and life. Therefore, choose life. By choosing to embrace water, by choosing to support those who are protecting our water and seeing it not simply as a commodity to be bought, sold, used, and discarded, but as a sacred gift, as part of ourselves, are choosing life. And I'll just close with a quote from the former editor-in-chief of Orbis Books, Philip Sharper. It's only when we can see the invisible that we can attempt the impossible. We can see that invisible future through the people embracing the sacred mystery of water.